In the new book, How the Hell Did This Happen?, celebrated humorist P.J. O'Rourke takes on the stranger than fiction and stranger than fact 2016 presidential election. He looks at the Republicans, the Democrats, the Libertarians, the press, the pundits. He even looks inward at himself. This election cycle was so absurd that despite being a diehard conservative, P.J. O'Rourke endorsed Democratic candidate Hillary Clinton. He talks about it all in the new book, and we talked to him this morning. P.J. O'Rourke has written 18 books on subjects as diverse as politics and cars and etiquette and economics. He is also a regular panelist on NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, and we welcome P.J. O'Rourke to the roundtable this morning. Good morning, P.J. How are you?
I'm okay. I abide.
Let's look at the title for a second. How the hell did this happen? What do you mean by this?
Well, I would say not only the outcome of the 2016 presidential election, but the whole darn election cycle, starting as it did in about 1804 or something.
I guess as a longtime humorist and satirist, I think this seems to be the general consensus among people in your company, which is that you couldn't make this up. This is stranger than fiction.
It got out ahead of me. There was no doubt. You know, you would make a seemingly ridiculously exaggerated statement about some political candidate, and the next day that candidate did that very thing or said that very thing or advocated that very position. It was extremely frustrating. As I pointed out, you know, I'm a political satirist, and the whole election was self-satirizing. I'm a political humorist. I couldn't be funnier than Hillary's pantsuits. I'm a political commentator, and I couldn't get a word in edgewise with Donald Trump on the Twitter 24/7. You know, I just wound up basically unemployed.
You go back to June of 2015, where you start looking at all of this and watch it unfold, and it was quite a circus right from the beginning, wasn't it?
It really was. I mean, it was a terribly overcrowded field on the Republican side, so you knew some silly stuff was going to happen over there. And then it was a terribly uncrowded side on the Democratic ticket. But you knew for sure one thing about the Clintons is that they will always bring trouble with them. If there doesn't happen to be any, they will BYO.
When you look at the field, was there anyone, I'm curious as to what you made of the field. I mean, was there someone that you thought, oh, of course, well, this will be the person who will rise to the top? Or did that start to get questioned right away?
Well, it didn't take long, it's true. But I would say at the onset, if we go back to 2015, I just sort of assumed, along with like most of the rest of the of punditry, that it would be Jeb versus Hillary. But that started to unravel pretty quickly.
What happened to Jeb?
Yeah, what did happen to Jeb? I mean, he had it all. You know, I mean, he was, a successful businessman, Phi Beta Kappa, young for a Republican, and a former governor of Florida, where balloting incompetence and corruption is vital to the GOP. Plus, he was rolling like a dirty dog in campaign contributions, you know. And then, you know, I got to say, on a kind of personal note, being a small town New Hampshire guy, I got to see almost all of these people up close and personal.
Right.
And Jeb came to a town meeting in Peterborough, New Hampshire, and he was wonderful, perfectly plausible as president, gave a very good presentation, had very sort of friendly affect, didn't lecture the audience, was patient with questions, amiable, all that. How it was that none of that seemed to come across on the campaign trail, I don't know.
Of course, the big surprise on the Republican side was the rise of Donald Trump. We'll get to that in a moment. But of course, on the Democratic side, it was the rise of Bernie Sanders, who is in your neighboring state of Vermont. Given that the closeness, did you see that coming at all?
No, no, absolutely I didn't. And I do think Trump and Sanders were part of a larger pattern, a pattern that we're seeing not just in the United States, but all over the world, which is looking for somebody. There's kind of a revolt against the elites going on, and not without reason. I mean, there have been a number of things having to do with the changing economy, changing demographics, refugee crises, immigration pressures, in particular the situation in the Middle East, where the elites don't seem to have done a very good job. But I was surprised that people were willing to go so far outside, looking for an outsider, that they were willing to go so far outside as Bernie Sanders, let alone Donald Trump.
As a conservative yourself, when did you start to become alarmed?
Yeah, probably later than I should have. I was laughing this Trump off until he began winning primaries. Actually, I think I started to get alarmed when I was covering the New Hampshire primary, and I spent a lot of time with Trump supporters, and I liked them. I did not find them to be racist, bigot, so on and so forth, alt-right lunatics. What I found them mostly to be was small business people and skilled tradesmen, which is, you know, that's basically the same thing. When you're a skilled tradesman, you are a small businessman.
Right.
And their main complaint was a tremendous burden of regulation that they felt at all levels. And I got to talking to one guy who obviously had a good sense of humor, and I just really liked him. He owned like a couple of gas stations and a towing operation or something. And he said, you know, I'm doing all right, he said, but I'm just regulated to death. I've got these old gas tanks that need to come out. I can't get the local and state and federal permits to get them out of the ground. I can't get all the permits to put new ones in. You know, the saying that, like, the dump out back of my garage is wetlands. Like, all this, you know, stuff is going. And then he said, like, you know, it comes to something like Obamacare. He said, I can afford that for my employees, but what I can't afford is the paperwork. He said, every time some genius in Washington comes up with a new idea, they never think about that as being a stack of paperwork on my desk. He said, I don't have a legal department. I don't have a human resources department. It's just me and my wife. And I'm not a paperwork guy. I'm a mechanic. And he said, you know, this stuff keeps loading up and loading up. And it's just driving me nuts. And so I had been laughing with him earlier about Trump's personality and so on. And so I said to him, I said, and electing a lunatic president, like, fixes this how? and he laughed. He said, I don't know. I don't know. But I've just had it up to here, you know. And so, you know, my conclusion, at least here, I mean, this, you know, may not be universal, but when the people I talk to and people I know that voted for Trump didn't vote for Trump. They voted against Hillary. They voted against a lot of things, actually, not against her so much specifically necessarily, but they what they did was voted against the status quo. And I can understand their desire to shake things up. I cannot understand their choice of empty coffee cans in which to shake things up.
Given your conservative leanings and given the fact that you have talked about these issues for many, many years, when you were given that choice, as we all were, you chose Hillary Clinton over Donald Trump. And I guess the question I have, not so much about your personal decision making, is, but why do you think more conservatives didn't do that of exactly what you asked that gentleman of vote for the saner of the two?
Yeah, well, I'm not even sure Saner necessarily works. I so thoroughly disagree with Hillary about everything. Well, not to the point that I... Yes, of course she is a Saner of the two. But was it for me a Saner choice? Well, it was a choice with a lot less volatility.
Yeah.
I knew what I was getting with Hillary. What I was getting was an extension of the Obama administration. Now, there's a tremendous amount of things that I disagree with President Obama about. But we knew what we were getting. The nation had survived 8 years of President Obama. I figured that Hillary's term would probably be a one-term president. It's very unusual for for Americans to keep the same party in the White House for 12 years seems to be kind of the max, as poor George H.W. Bush found out. I figured that the cycle was turning and that we could endure 4 more years of, like I say, we knew what we were getting. There's a thing in the commodities market called the volatility index. You can actually, they call it buying and selling fear. You can actually buy a bet on whether market volatility will go up or go down. And I talked to a friend of mine that's in the commodities business, and I said, I've looked at this stuff, and this is just absolutely baffling to me. There's all these like Greek letters that measure types of volatility and so on. I said I just don't understand how people measure risk. And he said, look, if you could measure risk, it wouldn't be risk. So the VIX index was just way too high for me with Trump.
You say in the book, Donald Trump got most of his campaigning done on the cheap by making a public spectacle of himself. He set his pants on fire knowing that reporters and camera crews would have to cover the blaze. And they continue to cover the blaze.
Yeah, they certainly do. And he's a master of misdirection. He would have made a great stage magician, you know. Don't look at the hat, you know, look over here while I find the rabbit. that's my guess about his. There's also a certain naivety to the guy. I think when he spouts off about President Obama tapping Trump Tower, and what a lot of garbage poor President Obama would have to listen to if that was indeed the case. I don't think he realizes how serious, criminal. He's just made a criminal accusation, you know, the kind of accusation that got Nixon chased out of town. And partly I think that he doesn't understand how serious a statement like that or how serious any statement is. But it's partly also a sort of masterful misdirection. You know, if they're going to bring up Russia over here, I'm going to bring up something over here that's equally shocking.
So,
tiresome, I got to say.
So for many on the left, this is this administration is of great concern and a great deal of fear. And I'm wondering of how you're looking at it now, and which is really just another way of saying, how are you sleeping at night?
Yeah, well, I'm scared too. You know, I find myself, in fear league with the left, but I think they're making a terrible mistake by a sort of preemptive hysteria. I mean, the way to fight bad politics is to, you know, it's a war and it has to be fought one battle at a time. And so far, they've got the bond drive part down, you know. They've got the home front enthusiasm, you know, but in World War II, Germany and Japan had home front enthusiasm too, you know. It's like you're going to have to battle the guy bill by bill, presidential executive order by presidential executive order. Just gathering on the mall in pink hats is not going to do it. So, you know, my sort of general advice to people who oppose Trump, and in many ways, particularly on something like immigration, I oppose him too, is that, you know, concentrate your forces, focus on the issue, keep your voice down, talk sense. I've just been I'm a little surprised at how so far tactically and strategically inept a lot of the left has been. It's like they're out there like trying to build up support for Trump among Trump supporters, many of whom have to be understood as being very reluctant Trump supporters, as picking him as the the one person that didn't seem to be overconnected to the Washington establishment.
I agree with you, although I do think that there seems to be a lack of leadership on both sides. There seems to be a lack of leadership for both Republicans and Democrats, of people who will stand up to some of these, certainly some of the more outrageous policies.
Yeah, I mean, we can't depend on the right. We can't strictly depend on the libertarians, who, incidentally, the capital L, I mean, I'm a small L libertarian, but the capital L libertarians ran a terrible, I mean, you would think that this would have been a moment where they would have attracted a lot of support and enthusiasm. Just ran an absolutely miserable campaign. I mean, Gary Johnson seemed to be asleep. I mean, he thought Aleppo was a brand of dog food.
Yeah, and yet there were so many things to make fun of in this election. It's hard to even know where to begin. That kind of got lost.
Yeah. I mean, Gary and Bill Weld were well down the list. You know, if I lived in a pure red state or lived in a pure blue state instead of living in a swing state like New Hampshire, I would have voted Libertarian. But as it was, with New Hampshire in play, and with it being the you know, outcome being unclear right down to the wire, I felt I actually, you know, there was a chance that my single little vote would tip the balance, you know. And so, you know, you had to go into the voting. I went straight down the Republican side without a single wince, even if I knew that the some of the Republican office seekers might not have been quite up to snuff. I did the straight Republican ballot, except for the very tippy top.
So in your job during the campaign of your writing, of course, your regular panelist on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Did it affect it? I mean, did you go about things differently than you normally do because you just had to? It was very tough to get the mood of the room.
No, I don't think I really did. I mean, I like it best when I hate everybody. the danger with meeting a politician and talking to a politician is that. I mean, they wouldn't be where they are. They wouldn't be a successful politician if they didn't have the capacity to charm, and I'm as open to it as anybody. And you may notice in the book that I'm very soft on Rand Paul because I know him a little bit. I just really like the guy. You know?
So in the actual performing of the duties, then was it fun? I mean, obviously, as someone who is trying to find humor, there is great humor out there. Or is it one of those situations that you laugh till you cry?
Well, all situations involving laughter have to do with laughing till you cry. I mean, Mark Twain pointed out that the secret source of laughter is not joy but sorrow. So that's all. I mean, you know, and I've been blessed with an appropriately dark sense of humor. So it was fun, you know. Difficulty for me arises in a situation like when you've got Reagan running against Jimmy Carter or something like that, where I feel really strongly about one side or the other, and you know, it's not my job to pick favorites, but you can't help but having some.
So as you look at your job now over what we presume will be the next 4 years, do you look forward to that for the comedic possibilities, or does the fear that we talked about sort of overtake that?
Oh, no. It's both of the above. You know, I mean, that's no, I wouldn't make fun of things if they didn't scare me. You know,
good point. So, sure.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's not. Michael O'Donohue, one of the original, you know, founders of the National Lampoon, used to say, humor is not a kitten tangled in a ball of yarn unless the kitten strangles. Harsh, but true.
We should note, and I hope I'm not giving anything away, but, you know, the book, How the Hell Did This Happen? I guess we don't really answer that question, do we?
Well, you know, specifically not, but generally in the last chapter, I try to show that this is part of a broad trend, broad global trend where people are feeling disconnected from their governments, and the results of this trend can be, well, you know, I mean, they can be Brexit as an example. But they can also, it's also reflected in the rise of people like Putin and Xi Jinping in China. I mean, Putin's authoritarianism and Xi Jinping's neo-Maoism are both based on public anger at the enormous corruption of previous governments, and looking for a strong man to fix this. Probably the worst example is this Duterte guy in the Philippines. I mean, the citizens of the Philippines were faced with a terrible problem with violent crime, and to fix it, they elected a violent criminal. It's just sort of homeopathy, I guess. I don't know what was... I covered the Philippines back in the 80s, but it's been a long time since I've been there. I don't know what the heck was going on. And so, you know, this is revolt against the elites can have milder, benign, maybe even some good effects here and there, as people point out that the changes in the new economy, the internet economy, is, you know, leaving a lot of people behind and causing, you know, major disturbances that need to be addressed, certainly at least acknowledged. But it's definitely got a sinister side to it.
Well, the new book is How the Hell Did This Happen? The Election of 2016. The book is published by Atlantic Monthly Press. PJ O'Rourke, it's always a pleasure to have you on the program. A delight. Thank you very much for sharing
with us. Well, thank you.
Thank you. Again, the title of the book, How the Hell Did This Happen? The Election of 2016 by PJ O'Rourke, published by Atlantic Monthly Press. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.